Welcome to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part radio series which will look at the deep connections between land and culture. The purpose of the program is to remember this connection between land and culture and to look at where agriculture came from in the state and where it's going. With scholars, farmers, and ranchers, we will look at where New Mexican agriculture has come from, with the Native nations to the Spanish and Indo-Hispano settlers to the Anglo-European settlers. We will also explore how national and global trends in agriculture have affected and are affecting the state. Agriculture can be seen as the most basic connection that people have to the land. Our food comes from the land, and the water gives plants and animals life and is inevitably affected by agriculture. Traditions and rituals have developed surrounding food and the care of land and water. Prayers and ceremonies are often associated with planting, harvesting, and eating. Today, though, we are disconnected further and further from this process. Our food comes from far across the nation and over the sea, planted and picked by people that we don't know in conditions that we are unaware of. Land and water are being transferred from agriculture to development at astonishing rates to keep up with urban growth. And the very charm of New Mexico, the reason that so many people move here from other places, is disappearing. To understand the connection between land and culture, first, we should understand what culture is.
Culture is a big term. People talk a lot about culture. Anthropologists talk a lot about culture.
This is Sylvia Rodriguez, professor of anthropology at the University of New Mexico and author of the book Acequia, Watersharing, Sanctity, and Place. Sylvia explains what culture is.
People talk about culture sometimes as if it were a thing that could be lost. And sometimes they talk about what culture consists of, like food, language, ritual, things like that. Anthropologists first started out defining culture sort of as people's ways of doing things, and often came up with a kind of inventory of what consisted of culture. But we've had a lot of debate about the nature of culture and whether our initial definitions of it that sort of talked about it almost as if it were a unitary, bounded thing that showed continuity through time. We've sort of moved away from that. And I guess I would say more simply that culture is what people do, how they do it, and the meanings that they give to it, how they talk about it.
So let's explore what people in what is today New Mexico did and how they did it.
But then may I ask this? What is the word for earth?
The word for earth is Nang O Chukujo.
Okay. And how would you say that in English?
How you would say Nang O Chukujo in English is unripe earth, O woman.
Tessie Naranjo and Sue Ellen Jacobs are the co-directors of the Northern Pueblos Institute at Northern New Mexico College in Española. Tessie comes from the Santa Clara Pueblo. Here, the two talk about language and how Tewa-speaking people relate to the earth.
The word for the earth is Nang. The word for us is Nang.
So, living so close to that understanding and appreciation as you do, it's hard to remember that we start with the language as a way of forming our concepts. And as long as the language can remain there, and children keep asking, what is that we are again? What is that down there again? And if they make that connection, we are the earth. We are the earth. The earth is us.
All of these are examples of how the land and our cultures are connected.
And the tribes are trying to develop these herds for a lot of health reasons, because of we have a lot of diabetes, a lot of heart disease, obesity, that at one point in our history wasn't there. So that's a big reason why a lot of tribes have gotten into it, plus the cultural reasons, you know, that cultural connection that has always been there with the bison.
This is Danny Sam, who heads the bison program at Picuris Pueblo. Many different nations around the country have begun to bring back the bison with the Intertribal Bison Cooperative. Mr. Sam explains what the buffalo was for Native cultures.
You know, at one point in our history here at Picuris Pueblo, they were hunted for food, and they ranged up as close as the Mora Valley, just about 30 miles east of here. They were monitored, they were watched, and of course, you know, it had to be a group of strong young people that knew how to process that animal out there in the field. You know, it wasn't something that was killed and then brought back. You know, it all had to be processed there where all that was done. So, you know, I'm sure it took a lot of effort to do that. You know, there was a lot of trading that went on with different tribes, different plains tribes came in over to this area, or Picaries and other pueblos within this area. They went out to the plains too, and I'm sure they did the same thing. That's where that culture lies. We still practice an annual buffalo dance here, as most pueblos do. So there's that cultural significance, and you know, it's to honor that animal and to pray for more of them to be available. At one time it was an economic source. You know, we traded goods, different products that were made from that animal, meat, hides, even tools, utensils that were made from them.
Seeds are important because our ancestors developed a relationship with plants that allowed their cultivation for food and medicine. And this has been our central element of our culture and our survival for millennia.
Luis Hina from the Tesuque Pueblo is part of the Traditional Native American Farmers Association. He's worked with a number of other pueblos and the New Mexico Acequia Association to educate the state legislature on the importance of protecting native seeds from the threat of being contaminated by genetically engineered crops. He explains why seeds are so important.
And the saving seeds, why they're important, is that just as our families are attached to our homes, our seeds learn to thrive in their place of cultivation by developing a relationship with the soil, the water, agricultural practices, ceremonies, and prayers, thereby giving seeds a sacred place in our families and communities. The way in which seeds become attached to a place makes them native seeds, also known as land races, also makes them an important element of the generational memory of our communities.
Esteban Arellano, journalist, author, and farmer, explains the mixture of culture that took place when agriculture moved from the Middle East to Spain into what is today Mexico, and on into what is now northern New Mexico.
In 711, it took about 45 acres of land for one family of four to survive. After the Arabs came into the Iberian Peninsula and introduced the acequia system of irrigation, about 1 acre or four people could survive on 1 acre of land, which is a big difference. And that is a model that came into Mexico, and there it was taught to, like, the Tlaxcaltecan Indians, who were the ones that also came under contract with the crown into New Mexico, because the Tlaxcaltecans were never subjugated by the Spanish. They were able to deal with them at the same level and enter into contracts with them. And they were the ones that were contracted by the crown to come into northern Mexico and eventually into New Mexico, and to lay out the acequias and the agricultural landscape that we know today. And that's mostly based on the work that a friend of mine from Mexico City, Dr. Tomas Martinez Saldana, has done on the Tlaxcaltecan Indians and their influence in terms of the agriculture. That's what, you know, I wanted to clarify, that the Spanish really had very little. You know, the only thing they had is that it was the Spanish crown who sponsored the people that came here, you know, but the Spanish, you hardly find anything that they really contributed to agriculture. The Tlaxcaltecas they're a totally different Indian tribe, you know. They were the Aztecas. They were never conquered by the Aztecas. You know, the Tlaxcaltecas are probably the only tribe from, they lived around what today is Mexico City, you know, but they were totally separate type of tribe, you know. Mm-hmm. Though the language that they spoke was Nahuatl, but the Tlaxcaltecas were very astute people. They were great agriculturalists, and 400 families came with Don Diego, with Don Juan de Oñate when he came here in 1598, versus only 129 families of peninsulars and criollos and mestizos that that came with him. So you can tell that there were a lot more. But history has a way of being told in black and white. You know, it's always been the Spanish versus the Indians. And the way I see the history in northern New Mexico, there's a lot of shades of gray. So it's not that simple that the Spanish and the Indians, you know, they were, even Don Juan de Oñate, I think, was also a mestizo, and a lot of the people that came with him were all already mixed bloods, you know. And they were not all from what today is Spain, you know. There were some from the Canary Islands, there were others from Greece, there were from France, you know, from all over Europe were people that came into this part of the world.
There's evidence that people lived here.
John Hunter, professor and the public historian for New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, explains how the early European settlers passed through the southern part of the state.
And also, since summer is not the time to live here, and that's the growing season, there might not have been a whole lot of agriculture here. But there were settlements here, and people did live here, at least they passed through. And there also are some ruins that are around here as well. The Europeans have passed through here since the 16th century. Explorers passed through here in the middle part of the 16th century. And then, of course, Don Juan de Oñate led a party of about 700 people passing through here on the way up north in 1598. But from 1598 to the early 19th century, there were no settlers. Partly because this was very isolated and inhospitable, partly because the Apaches and other tribes were around and didn't allow settlers to stay for very long. So the Europeans who were here for that time period, just Paso Por Aquí, just passed by here on the way up to northern New Mexico on Camino Rio, on the El Camino Rio.
Fancy trees that we have.
I know. How did they do it?
With wooden.
I went to help clean an acequia, which comes from the Truchas Peaks, high in the mountains, through forests and gnarly roads with a crew of about 12 people. The acequias, or ditches, if you're in the south, were the first thing that a community had to build in order to bring water from the mountains and rivers to irrigate crops. The acequia was and still is a form of governance for a community. It's a culture of water sharing and community cooperation. Filimon Sanchez of Ojosarco took a short break from shoveling rocks out of the water's path so that it could flow down the mountain to the fields that were just beginning to grow in the early spring. He explained what it took to make the acequias.
Wooden shovels.
Wooden shovels. Yeah. Really? How long do you think it took them?
It took them a long time, but they were covered just about 24/7. They would bring their wagons and their camps, their families, their chickens, and they would just hang out here and work. People got hurt here, you know, trees and all kinds, you know, falls and they might have been run over by horses or something, you know, because they used to bring their teams and their plows and their scrapers and and that's how they did it.
Is this part of the Acequia Madre?
Yeah, this is now the Acequia Madre, yeah.
So this is formed for Piñasco and...
But this Acequia was originally built by tramperos. And they were residing and farming the place known as Cañada de los Alamos, in between the village of Las Trampas and Ojo Zarco, mm-hmm. as you travel to the high road to Taos. Mm-hmm. There's Cañada de los Alamos right in between. There's a nice farmland there. and they farmed it. You know, they're very fertile lands, and they still are. So, the people of Ojos Zarco had constructed another acequia to the place called Ranchos Viejos in Mesteñas, and it's only like a 3.5 mile distance from the source to the Ojos Zarco village. And this one is 8 miles, you know, from the source here at the river. Mm-hmm. And then there's still an additional mile from there to the measuring box where the Rito de San Leonardo tributes into the Trampas River. Mm-hmm. And it's measured there. And then we take it down. We take it at the presa, at the diversion box. There we measure again, and we measure, you know, what we're entitled to.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we explore the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico.
The first European settlers were, it's hard to say because it's kind of lost in the mist of memory.
Dr. Hunter explains why Europeans began to settle southern New Mexico.
There were other, after Mexico won its independence from Spain, Mexico started giving land grants to people in the southern part of the state here, as well as other parts. And so there were some land grants that European settlers started to get into in the 1830s. But it was always a bit dicey because of the Apaches who were around. But there were some land grants, 1830s, 1840s. Then in 1846, when the Mexican-American War occurred and the United States came in and took this land from Mexico, they brought in the military. And the military presence here was sizable, so much so that the Apache raids lessened. So that people then started creating bigger and bigger communities. And it was centered around agriculture, centered around the river, even though the river's flows go up and down with the seasons and with rainstorms. But still, it was an agricultural way of life here from the 1840s for at least a few decades.
Yeah, my name is Roger Bow, and Granddad established this ranch in 1907, so it's 100 years old this year. And there's been a Bow here ever since. Hopefully we can stay a little longer anyway.
Roger Bow ranches near San Juan in the eastern part of the state. He explains how his family made it to their homestead.
My great-grandfather was a veterinarian in Hereford, Texas, which is about 60 miles as the crow flies east of here. And whenever they started homesteading in this area, my granddad and my great-granddad come down and dug some dugouts and stayed here and homesteaded what they could. And then over the years, my granddad hung on through some really, really tough times. They tried to farm a lot of this area in here, and it just didn't work. And in the 30s, pretty much drove everybody out. I remember him telling me a story about the government come in and it was so dry the cows had nothing to eat and stuff. And at that time they didn't have supplemental feed or any way to get feed to the cattle. And so they come out and shot them and buried them. And my granddad let them do a few and he couldn't stand it anymore. And he said for them to stop. And he stuck through the drought of the 30s and a lot of people started leaving, and he started buying up the property, and so this is what we have today. At one time, there was like 10 to 12 families on this ranch. It was pretty tough to make a living. They were pretty dirt poor, as you say. And I know whenever I first moved back in 1980, I counted 10 family farms or ranches that were within 5 years of my age, and now I'm about, there's me and one other guy left. So, or, you know, a lot of things have changed even in the last 20, 30 years.
Professor Hunter had explained some of the major occurrences which shifted agriculture in the state. One was the railroad, another was the building of Elephant Butte Dam. Here he explains what began a lot of the most recent changes in New Mexico's agriculture.
So World War II put strains on the agricultural community here, partly because so many men went off to fight. Mm-hmm. And it took away the farmers who had been working the fields. And then when those men came back, some did go back into farming, but some didn't. Sometimes they went back to orchards that hadn't been tended over the 4 years of war, and they had died. And this isn't just down here. I know up in Placidus, a friend of mine took me through a level field that had been an orchard before the war, that his uncles had worked, and when they came back from fighting, the orchard had died because nobody was there to water it. And so some of the agriculture around the state died just because of that. And then also there was a shift. I talked with this one gentleman in Hillsboro who, when he was about 5 or 6, went on the last goat drive. I guess you can't call it a cattle drive, but a goat drive from Hillsboro down to the trailhead at Nutt. And that's about 40 or 50 miles. So they drove the goats from Hillsboro down there and put them on freight cars there. But that was the last one, and that was right after the war. And so then livestock production shifted from goat and sheep, at least in some of these communities, to cattle. And now it's predominantly cattle.
Land and culture are tied, and major changes in agriculture inevitably affect culture. Miguel Santisteban, ethnobiologist and a leader in the New Mexico Acequia Association, talks about some of the trends nationally and globally with agro-industrial corporations.
Well, you know, without even having to talk about seed companies, you know, there's this whole phenomenon of corporations. And now we exist in a situation where the corporations have more rights than people. So it's almost like the corporation is a person that has more rights than everybody else. And my biggest concern with corporations right now is that they think that they have the right to patent life forms and profit off of those life forms.
He's talking about chemical corporations such as Monsanto, who have changed the DNA of life forms such as corn, cotton, soybean, and canola to name only the most produced. He was also referring to the corporation's history with the courts and with the legislature to create policy that benefits them. For example, in 2000, Percy Schmeiser, a seed-saving canola farmer in Canada, had his crops contaminated by a neighbor's genetically engineered seed. Monsanto sued Percy for theft, and the courts ruled in the chemical company's favor. Monsanto has an annual budget of $10 million set aside for 75 people to investigate and prosecute any farmer who they feel has stolen their patented technology of genetically engineered seeds. Today, a great majority of the crops grown in the southeastern part of New Mexico are genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, also called GE seeds. They cost less and have less risk for farmers who must survive in today's competitive global economy. Another trend is the transference of land and water from agriculture to development. This is Ernie Atencio from Taos Land Trust. He talks a little about how development has reduced agricultural lands. He's talking about Taos County. However, agricultural lands are being transferred to development all over the state. The Middle Rio Grande, including Albuquerque, continues to expand with population. Areas such as Taos, known for its rural culture and scenery, are being threatened by second homes, which affect communities in a variety of ways.
I don't have numbers in terms of acreage, but I do know that in the last 10 years or so, nationwide, there's been an 18% reduction in the number of farms. And that doesn't necessarily translate directly into acreage, but an 18% reduction in the number of farms. In Taos County, it's been a 29% reduction in the number of farms. And that could mean a lot of things. I mean, maybe the land is still there and open and undeveloped, but people have just stopped farming it. But nonetheless, that economy is dwindling. We just I think it's absolutely critical, even if people aren't going to farm the land right now, to at least protect it, to keep that potential for the future. As a friend of mine likes to say, asphalt is your last crop. So once you make that decision to pave it over and develop it, there's no going back. So we're just trying to work with people to save it for now so that we have that potential in the future.
Many communities have worked to create a more localized food economy to ensure food safety, personal health, and to maintain the local economy. Nationally, we've seen that land has become so expensive that it doesn't pay to farm. This has also become a trend here as demand for land has pushed the prices up. Again, Esteban Arellano.
But I've seen so many people come through the Embudo Valley that wanted to be farmers, and but the first thing they were concerned with, well, how much money am I going to make and can I survive? And after 2-3 years, they haven't survived economically, so they move on to another career. And those of us that are traditional, we have remained here because what I plant, what I grow, and the trees that I have, I don't even think about it in an economic terms. It's for me, for my family, and for friends and relatives that I grow, the food that we grow, and the trees that I have. You know, if I was to look at it from an economic point of view, I wouldn't be doing it because I'm losing money. But that's not the reason I do what I do. I do it because it's part of who I am and because I enjoy doing it, and not because of an economic incentive that I'm going to become rich, or at least that I'm even going to be able to survive. I have to find other ways of making a living. But it's just for being able to be outside exercising, and then for even for a short period of time of just tasting what a real fruit tastes like, you know, what a real peach, what a real apricot, a real green chili or a corn, just go and pluck it from the plant and bring it inside. I have some asparagus. Even in that book that I did on the other volume that we're working on, it says there about the asparagus that the best way to eat the asparagus is just to go into the field where you're growing them, make a fire there, and cook them right there and eat them. Well, of course, that's what I try to do here. You know, my asparagus, I bring them in 5 minutes before we're going to cook them. And you can't compare the taste that those asparagus have with the ones you buy at the store. Even if they're brought in from California, by the time they get here, they're probably 10 days old that they have been harvested.
These are some of the themes that we will explore in the coming programs of The Shift of Land. We will also ask the question, what does it mean to be New Mexican? Does it mean that you're connected to the land, that you recognize the connection of your culture and the land? The purpose of this program is to remember the connection between land and culture, to look at where agriculture came from in the state and where it's going. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappett for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.